we were disqualified on the basis of a prior representation. And really what we have today, we believe, is the Honorable Bill Coker applying incorrect standard in his disqualification order, because specifically, I believe that the law in Texas is very clear as far as when a firm is asked to sue a former client, can he do so? The question is, are the matters substantially related to what the prior representation was? I think that when the court reads, I'm sure the court has read the order entered by Judge Coker in this case, he did not find that there was a substantial relationship between the issues. The reason he did not find that was because there was not a substantial relationship between the issues. Rather, what he found was that the matters were similar enough that there might be a situation where a confidence could be utilized in the second case. Now, in order, it's easy to say substantial relationship. The real question I submit is, what does that really mean? I think that the Texas cases have not been pinpoint in the analysis of what is the substantial relationship. The Howard Hughes case, I did not recall a substantial relationship like versus theirs. Basically, all the Texas cases say the test is substantial relationship, but then what does that really mean? I think that the best way to really try to do that, the only way to do that, is to really look at the issues involved in the case. I believe a Fifth Circuit case, which we cite, the Heidel case, says that unfortunately the only way to do it is a painstaking analysis of the particular issues involved in each case. Now, if we do that in this case, the court will realize that our law firm, Bob Hamilton, was retained in late 1985, early 1986, by a group of plaintiffs to litigate against Republic Insurance Company, possibly Republic Financial Insurance Company. I have to look at the pleadings. Anyway, in connection with their breach of a reinsurance treaty, or treaty, and that's it. The other lawsuit is, of course, in the statement of fact in this case we introduced into evidence. And when you read that case, it's evident that there are two groups of plaintiffs, the Walker plaintiffs and the Frontier plaintiffs. The Frontier plaintiffs, none of them were parties to this particular lawsuit, were suing the reinsurance company, trying to keep them from canceling their reinsurance treaty. The Walker plaintiffs, which included National County Insurance Company and other insurance companies, as well as Western Fire, were trying to receive damages for the cancellation of the reinsurance treaty. That's all. Our particular firm was replaced after about 5 months, and there's not really a dispute on that, when the judge in Dallas ruled that that particular case, the suit over the arbitration, was arbitrable rather than litigable. And so consequently, a firm in Chicago and another firm in Dallas replaced this firm. We had nothing further to do with it. Now, this particular case that we're about today, the bank, Republic Bank, ICNT, Texas, had insurance policies issued to it basically on leases. They would buy leases, and this would be credit insurance guaranteeing or ensuring that the lease payments would be made. And in 1988 is when the defaults were made on the policy and this suit began. Now, of course, in 1988 was more than 2 years after our firm was replaced. Our firm never had anything to do with these particular policies and questions, never had anything to do with the inception of the policies, never had anything to do with the administration of the policies, never had anything to do with claims against the policies. In short, didn't have anything to do with credit bond insurance policies. The only relationship whatsoever was a tangential relationship that these particular insurance policies were, in fact, reinsured by Republic Insurance Company. But again, looking at the pleadings in the other case and the matters in the other case, those policies didn't have anything to do with that other case. That other case was strictly reinsurance. Now, it brings us back to what is substantially related to it. I submit under really a test, these two issues were not substantially related, and that's the reason that Judge Coker didn't find substantially related. He painted with a very broad brush. He said that the case had some similarity, which we don't really think to do, but had some similarity, and so consequently there is a possibility that there could have been a confidence share that could be used later. Well, of course, under this test, I submit that you could really never sue a former client, and if that's what you say the rule is, so be it, we'll know what it is and we know how to follow it. But any time you represent a client, it would always be possible for a client to say something to you. And that could be a confidence, and you could have it later on totally unrelated matter. And the client could say, well, I told him something in confidence, and now, consequently, he shouldn't be able to use that. Well, that's a Canon 4 violation, that you cannot, in fact, use confidence. The test on suing a former client isn't really so much what was said, because in a substantial relationship, it assumes, and most courts will allow it to be assumed, that there could be some sharing of confidences. The question is, are the issues so substantially related that it is presumed there would be some confidences? The Braun versus Valley Ear, Nose, and Throat case, which is a Texas case, I don't believe was cited in the brief, I could be wrong, it's 611 Southwest Section 170. And that is a case where a doctor from California specifically said he had told the lawyer that he was trying to qualify all about his financial state, all about his whole situation involving his financial affairs and his matrimony, and then later on the doctor represents the group of doctors that sued him, and he says, of course, that's improper. The court says, well, the only thing he really counseled them on was the effect of a California judgment on a divorce, and consequently the effect of that really doesn't have anything to do with the situation of what is your financial situation involving this particular case. Well, the analogy there is the doctor said, well, I talked about something that where it really wasn't related to that case, but I share a confidence. The court says, well, that's not the test. The test is, are the matters substantially related? And they really cite a Second Circuit case, Silver Chrysler case, and the Second Circuit, I submit, is a fairly important circuit because that's where the substantially related test first came from. I think it first came from a D.C. theater test. The Second Circuit has adopted the standard that the issues must be identical or patently clear. They have additionally followed the standard that a Canon 9 violation, you don't apply indiscriminately, and you don't apply, except in a very narrow sense, finding first that there has to be a specific violation of Canon 4 or some other specific violation involved. Now, the Silver Chrysler case cited by the Braun case is a situation where a lawyer for one law firm that had been representing Chrysler Corporation for a number of years, an associate, goes to another firm, and, of course, the other firm then sues Chrysler, and Chrysler disqualified, and the other lawyer saying, well, you were with this firm. You clearly either knew or had access to all the information that you're suing us on now, and you just can't do that. Second Circuit didn't have too much trouble in saying, well, you have to look at the issues involved. Just because he was with a firm that had been representing him through the years, that by itself is not enough. This particular case, remember our facts, we had two lawyers, Bob Hamilton, that worked on the specific reinsurance matter for about 4 or 5 months in 1986. After we became employed in connection with the matter against Western China, we have shielded them off, with the term Chinese law, from anything to do with this particular case. Interestingly enough, also, I think you'll see in the testimony that as far as documents, let's say I wanted to be tricky one Saturday night, sneak in and see the documents in this whole case, assuming they're related or not. All those documents, everything having to do with the prior representation, was shipped out of our offices in the year 1986, more than 2 years prior to us ever getting involved in this case. And to go and violate the Chinese wall, violate everything we have, and try to find documents and try to see what the other case is about, I couldn't even do it. They're not there.
Under your argument, I take it, though, this Chinese wall is not necessary. That's not,
I don't think the Chinese wall is necessary.
You would be here making the same argument you've made up until that point, even if the former lawyers were involved in this.
I think that's correct, although we want to make sure, we want to do everything we can, of course, to protect, and that's the reason we set up the wall. If there is some decision out of the Southern District here allowing a Chinese wall to be set up where the same law firm was suing under the same issue, and they in fact walled off their lawyers, there is contrary opinion out of the Dallas court, the Marshall opinion, not allowing that. In this particular case, we don't have the same lawsuit involved, so the Marshall opinion is not really analogous like the South Texas opinion is not analogous allowing it. So no, we don't have to wall it off, but we think it's more appropriate to go that way. There really can't even be any question about the propriety of it. Likewise, really what was being challenged, I find it interesting, curious, maybe I shouldn't, and the hearing, as when the court sees the motion and the written motion is filed by Western Fire, what they're really complaining about was that this law firm had access to financial information, financial statements, and ownership between the defendants and the current lawsuit. Now first of all, I suggest if this firm did, more than 2 years prior to the situation, and obviously financial situations have changed, and do change through the years, i.e. look at Republic Bank 2 years ago with Booming Bank, and now we have NCMB Texas. But possibly even more to the point is the financial statements complained about are all public records. I mean, and this was shown by the testimony. I mean, the financial statements of Western Fire are filed yearly with the Texas Insurance Commissioner. Walker General does the same thing. And so I never really understood, maybe this is my ignorance, why there was a complaint about the fact that this firm had access to financial information that was public record. I mean, this isn't even a situation where you have access to information that I could have gone out, assuming I'd worked on another case, and found by another matter or found by investigation. I mean, this is just a plain old public record. So
are you saying then that the things that you sought under discovery were already matters of public record?
In this particular case, everything I saw in discovery was not a matter of public record. The financial statements
well, the
that
question,
I saw
the question of your propriety of representing was not raised until the discovery
that's correct.
Process was begun.
That's correct.
But what was sought under discovery that was not a matter of public records that raised the question of the propriety of your representing?
There is nothing that I know of that was raised as far as being complained about that would not have been a matter of public record or had not been voluntarily given to us previously. I think you'll see in the testimony of this hearing that there had been some voluntary exchange of information by Western Fire and possibly Walker General after the inception of the present litigation and prior to the discovery request. You know, we'd ask to see some financial documents and information they give them to us. And so there could have been that was voluntarily produced, and the rest was public knowledge. I think it really, the financial standpoint, I really don't think it should be a realistic issue in this case because it's not a conflict, it's not a secret. And if you look at Canon 4 in the Texas rules, it's both confidences and secrets. Now, secrets are probably different than confidences because otherwise they wouldn't use both words. And I think you can have a secret that would not be a confidence under attorney-client privilege. But I don't think you can have a secret that's public record that is just, you know, you just come down here in Austin and look at those financial statements. And I don't think you have a secret when the other side voluntarily turns over the information. Again, that's the reason the courts have really adopted a substantial relationship test because they don't really want to get into situations. What was said? You know, was there a confidence said? Because that would force the former client to come in and say, well, you know, I told them I lied, I cheated, I was horrible. They don't want to, you know, the court generally doesn't want to have someone come in and say that. That's the reason we have to go through the laborious process of looking, and here I don't think it's that laborious. A suit on a reinsurance contract is not the same as suits on insurance policies.
Mr. Bowman, do you, to obtain mandamus in the case, do you have to show that Judge Coker applied the wrong test, or can you only show that he applied the right test wrong?
I think I do have to show an abuse of discretion. I think it is an abuse of discretion to show that he followed the incorrect standard of law.
Did he say that he was not going to follow the substantial relationship test?
Nowhere in the record did he say that he was not going to follow the substantial relationship test. I think what is in the record is what he actually did. What is also, I suppose, in the record, because I filed a reply to the response that was filed a couple of weeks ago, was you can see there's a proposed judgment proposed by the Western Fire defendants using the word substantially related or substantial relationship. I complained about it by letter, and then whether my complaint did any good or not, all I know is that the order then came out in the form that it came out, and the order as it came out did not have substantial relationship, it had similar enough. And the similar enough test is an incorrect test of law, and so I think if you apply the incorrect test of law, then you have an abuse of discretion. Also, if there's no evidence to support the finding, I would support that there was an abuse of discretion, and we think here, even if you were to follow the correct test, if you look at the evidence, it's just not there. And so that's the reason I think that the discretion is something that
the question's been raised about NCNB's standing in this lawsuit, and that it has not been substituted. It has not substituted itself in the underlying action. Could you address that, please?
Well, the only way I can address it is my understanding that it has, in fact, not been substituted.
Okay.
And, yes, I think that what I can do, and I can, with permission of the court, is to send a supplemental transcript from the Dallas District Court. But it's my understanding I got a copy of it in the condition of police last week from the current counsel representing NCNB.
The second question I have is, the number of mandamuses filed in this court has increased from about 5 a year to about 150 a year, and for various reasons. My question to you is, do you have a remedy by appeal?
My remedy by appeal is not a remedy that would work, is all I can say by the time. I think the remedy is mandamus. Their case is showing, you know, the side of mandamus is the proper remedy. If, in fact, NCNB had to wait until the case was tried, and on appeal, it wouldn't matter whether we were the counsel or not because the case would be over and it being up 2 or 3 years down the line. So I really don't think in this situation I do have a right of appeal. If I have a right of appeal, it's certainly not an effective right of appeal. And that's the reason I believe that the case, not just in Texas, but all over generally the country, mandamus is recognized as a method to try to appeal immediately this qualification. And so that's the reason that appeal would not be appropriate.
Is there any stay in the underlying suit for during this proceeding? I know other attorneys have substituted in.
No.
So we may, I guess it's no concern of ours, but the practical effect of this opinion may really just relate to future actions anyway.
Well, it's possible, I suppose, it's long enough. I would think that probably a practical effect would have a situation that there would be substitution back in and that we wouldn't handle the case, and the case would, in fact, be tried by us. It is what I would think that the practical effect would be. And again, I don't think I really mentioned it because it's evidence, but again, looking at the record, the burden is on the other side to show and present the evidence and to convince everyone that there is a substantial relationship. The burden really isn't on us to prove that there's not. And I really think that the only thing really shown is this claim about the financial relationship and the financial statements. And again, we think that's just a totally frivolous matter. And I think it is important now for this court to clearly establish what is the substantial relationship test. Is it that using the Second Circuit, the issues have to be identical or have to be clear? Or is it a looser test? Is it a test that even paint with a broader brush? I don't think it should be a test with a broader brush because I think that would not look at the realities of modern-day law practice. Understand our our opponent doesn't want to look at the practicalities of larger law firms, lawyers transferring back and forth, lawyers moving to other law firms. But it happens. It happens, as the court well knows, with increasingly frequently, really. And consequently, I think that's another reason it's important for this court to articulate exactly what rules must be followed by the firm in connection with suits against the law firm.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, member of the case, will present argument from respondent.
If it please the court, my name is Tom Case, and I'm here on behalf of the respondent today. Let me go directly to the substantial relationship effects. Granted, the issue to be litigated in the public insurance litigation, and the issues to be litigated in this case are not the same issues. Our complaint was that there were certain matters going into in the public insurance litigation involving the ownership of Western Fire, Walton General, the financial status, the financial condition of these companies, as well as the relationship to an entity called National County Mutual Association, for which Walton General Agency was a general agent. Also gone into in that litigation was the financial effect cancellation of those reinsurance policies would have on Western Fire. Those reinsurance policies covered the policies of credit bond insurance that are an issue in this case. If an issue in this case from the outset has been the solvency of Western Fire, when we received the discovery request, we apprehended where NCMD, its predecessors, were alter ego theories of recovery against an individual by the name of Robert Walker, who is 100% shareholder of Walker Enterprises, and who is a part owner of Western Fire. In fact, that is exactly what the case is headed, or it is at this point. I tried to get the Second Amendment petition as a supplemental transcript in the part of the 298th court in Boston. I'm in limbo on that. Going to one question that just the spirits had, NCMB at this point has substituted the trial court. It is also now asserting claims of alter ego, claiming that Walker General Agency is the alter ego of Robert Walker, and that Western Fire is the alter ego of Walker General Agency and Robert Walker. And our point on the motion for disqualification is that not only did Vial Hamilton have this access to this information concerning the financial condition of these two defendants in this suit, and the relationship between the companies, and the ownership of the companies, is that all that information bears directly on this issue of alter ego.
But can't they find that out in this case? Through discovery or public channels or whatever?
Oh, they can find out the financial condition, but the point is that there were the testimony of the record on the disqualification is that there were conversations back and forth between Vial Hamilton and these two companies about the financial condition of the companies. I did not put on evidence of what the conferences were that were given. The fact of the matter is, I don't believe that the law requires me to put on that evidence, because then I had revealed the very thing I'm seeking to keep the firm from potentially revealing to its now client, NCMB, to the detriment of my clients.
But doesn't the confidence have to appear from the relationship between the two cases, the nature of the confidence?
I believe yes, it does, but the relationship, I do not believe, is the issues to be determined, but instead, are some parts of what was going into in both cases the same. And in these cases, they were.
But if the part that is gone into in both cases that is the same is all either public information or readily available through discovery, then why should the lawyer be disqualified from representing in the second case?
Because the courts presumed under Kevin Ford that there was an exchange of confidential information between the attorney and client concerning that information. And those financial statements will not have all the client's concerns, confidences, procedures concerning those matters.
The court presumes that? Is that in the rule?
It's in the case law that they presume that if part of the subject matter of both litigations is such, then there's a presumption of exchange confidences between the attorney and the client, and the courts that have dealt with the question have said that it's an irrebuttable presumption, that the attorneys will not be able to be allowed to put on evidence that they did not tell us confidences, and by the same token, they're not required to put on evidence as to what the confidences were. It would destroy the purpose of the rule, because it would drag everything out in the open that was presumably exchanged between the attorney and client in the form of litigation or proceeding. And going to the question of whether the issues must be exact and identical, I don't think that should be the test. Let me tell you why. Let's say that Val Hamilton had not represented Western Fire and Walter General in the public insurance litigation, but instead had rendered corporate tax advice to the firms, and through rendering that corporate tax advice, had access to and discussed with the client their financial condition, the relationship between the companies, the control between the companies and individuals that own the company. And while that may not have been a matter that was an issue in some tax proceeding, it would certainly be relevant to the issue in this proceeding where alter ego theories are being advanced. And it would certainly be of value to NCNB to have that information. And it would certainly be a detriment to my client for it to potentially be revealed to NCNB. And that's a reasonable filing motion for this qualification. We do not contend that there is evidence in this record that a specific impropriety has been committed by filing. What we're saying, and the basis of our motion for disqualification, was an apparent impropriety. And I believe the question is whether there is a reasonable possibility of the occurrence of an impropriety. And when the courts have looked at that question under Canon 9, they look at whether there may be evidence of a potential violation of another canon. And here is canon 4, to which there could be a potential violation. And our complaint is an appearance of impropriety and a reasonable possibility that there could be an occurrence of an impropriety. I'm not saying that it has happened, but we're concerned that it could happen. And of course, that would have to be the basis for disqualification. I want to go to order of Judge Coker. He did use the word similar to Brown. But I believe when you read Judge Coker's statements at the conclusion of the hearing on the motion to disqualify and take it with his order, I believe it's clear to me, and it was clear to the court, that he was utilizing the substantial relationship of text. And I think the question here today maybe more what are we going to mean by substantial relationship.
By the way, did you draw that order? Did he sign it?
No, I didn't.
Are you referring?
No, I did not. The order that I drew and submitted to the court is attached to Mr. Bowman's brief responding to our answer to the petition for writ of mandamus.
So this is the court's own language?
It's Judge Coker's own language.
Presumably. You didn't draw it, Mr. Bowman didn't draw it, so.
I'm going to have to make that assumption.
Yeah.
It certainly wasn't my language and it wasn't Mr. Bowman's language. But I believe when you examine it, that taken with the language, with the statements at the end of the hearing on disqualification, I think it's clear that it's following a substantial relationship text. He was concerned about the matter that we're going into between Western Fire and Walker General and Val Hamilton and the public insurance litigation, and the matters that they were seeking to go into NCNB and seeking to go into the discovery of this case. I really don't think that the evidence that we put on as to matters going into the public interest and matters going into the software be gone into by NCNB in this case is disputed. Mr. Baumgartner and Mr. Schoonover, who testified at this qualification hearing, did not testify that we didn't go into these matters. Mr. Baumgartner was given as an exhibit a request for production of documents that was propounded by the opposing side. He said, well, these are the only documents that we could use for the other side. My witness, Mr. Harden, testified that one of those documents were financial statements and also internal analyses of the financial condition of these two companies. And that there have been conversations back and forth between employees of Western Fire and Walton General by all happening about these various matters. Mr. Schoonover testified that he couldn't really remember whether they went into financial information or confidential information, but if Mr. Harden said they did, he'd take his word for it. Mr. Harden was not a witness. And Mr. Harden's testimony in that regard is not disputed in this record. And he testified, among other things, that out of the various items sought by the discovery request that triggered the motion for disqualification, that 11 of those items were items that were gone into the Republic Insurance Association, and that Val Templeton had access to all of the company's records with reference to those items, but that there were conversations back and forth between Western Fire and Walton General with members of Val Templeton about those items. And it again goes back to the question of a presumed sharing of confidences. I'll be the first person to concede that there's no evidence in this record about what confidences were exchanged. And I don't think the law puts that burden on my client to do so. I think that the law imposes these presumptions for the very reason otherwise these confidences that I want kept confident would have to be repeated in full public record containing this qualification. And it certainly puts the former client to a hostage choice. No, it hasn't been. You can't win, but you have to put on the evidence of the confidence of the plea.
Would you say that denying the application for mandamus in this case would greatly increase the power of a client to disqualify a former counsel?
No, I don't believe so. I believe there is existing law. I agree with Mr. Bowman that the Texas law really doesn't pinpoint this question. And he's right that there are cases out of, I believe, the Second Circuit saying that the issues must be identified. I believe the Fifth Circuit and Second Circuit have taken what I believe to be a more realistic approach, and that is, was there some part of that previous litigation through which counsel most likely or may likely have acquired information that relates to the subsequent litigation that would be of use to his present client against his former client. And it's a more flexible test that's involved, and I think it's a more realistic test. If you had to have the exact same identical issue in the previous litigation and present litigation, I think that would prejudice the client's, the former client's ability to protect its competencies. And I believe your question also touches on disqualification under Canon 9, under the parents of impropriety. You have a balancing test here. Would the possibility of public suspicion outweigh the social interest in obtaining counsel? And that's a balancing test that I think would have to be utilized by court on a case-by-case basis. In this case, with the testimony in this record, that Val Hamilton had access to this financial information, when there's information regarding ownership of these companies and the relationship between these companies. When we have an issue, issues in this case about financial solvency of Western Fire and issues of alter ego, that all go, as the court knows, a lot of evidence that goes into the question of alter ego is controlling, financing, relationship between the parties, ownership of things. And when you look at that and look at the potential for the use of that information against my client and their clients in their subsequent litigation, I believe that there is a strong possibility of public suspicion against Barr. I'm not saying that Val Hamilton is guilty of any sort of specific impropriety. I'm saying that it has gotten itself in a position where it could look to the public like they're in a position to do those conferences. When you balance that against the social objective of retaining counsel, the testimony in this record is that the predecessors of NCNB had at least 10 law firms in the Dallas area that represented on a regular basis. And I do not believe that NCNB has been prejudiced by the order of disqualification. I think strong evidence of that is the fact that at the conclusion of the hearing on the motion for disqualification, the firm of Gary and Davenport made an appearance on the record. He said, we're here, we're ready to go. And as a matter of fact, we've been conducting depositions that afternoon. I think that the social concern of retaining counsel here is minimal. This isn't a situation where NCNB is claiming this is the only firm that can represent us in the county. There isn't anybody else qualified or everybody else is disqualified. And we are going to be prejudiced in serving our rights in this case. We have 10 different law firms in the area, and one of those firms made an appearance within 2 minutes after Judge Coker announced his decision. That's all I have, unless anybody can remember the court has questions.
Thank you,
Counsel. Thank you.
Mr. Hall.
Thank you,
please report it. Initially, let me respond to the analogy on the corporate tax advice, because I think the easiest response to that is the Howard Hughes case, because that's really what was raised by the hospital that Andrews Kurth had been representing for over 20 years. That is that Andrews Kurth had been representing us for over 20 years, knows our policies, knows our financial conditions, they got tax rulings for us, knows everything that we do. So consequently, it's unfair for them to sue us when we're trying to get money out of Howard Hughes as well, and the Houston court had a little trouble saying that the issues are not substantially related, so therefore, just because you represent them for 20 years, do everything about it, does not disqualify you from suing against them in a matter that does not involve some issues. And that's really the easiest way to respond to that. Specifically, the 4 points I believe that were raised that caused the motion for disqualification to be filed were ownership. We talked about ownership, that's all public record anyway. Financial condition, we talked about that. One thing I may have not pointed out enough is the record is clear that financial statements were not given, financial information was not given by our law firm in connection with the other lawsuit. The financial condition in the other lawsuit did not get involved and information was not given to the public financial insurance until after this law firm had been replaced and a new law firm of one of this one Gross and Gardner and then were involved. That is testimony that you will see when you read Mr. King Harden's testimony. Mr. Harden did testify for the client. He got really exuberant some of his testimony, and we show in our response that we did 7 items that really refuted him. But some things he testified that we talked about with him really didn't occur until 2 years after we no longer represented that firm. The best example is the ultimate settlement of the Republic reinsurance litigation.
Let me ask you a question that's troubling me. The statement was made that certain financial data was made available to your firm, which was not available in public records, and that that data dealt directly with the issue of alter ego, which is involved in this case.
Well, I think first, 2 or 3 answers to that. Number one, I don't think there's any information in the record to support that. I think that when you read the record, the only thing they talk about is the what's called the annual statement that was filed in this particular case. Number two, if there is a concern of, well, also that their financial information, if we were given access to it, I think very clearly no one ever said it was given to us, no one ever said we had an opportunity, no one ever said we knew what was there. The statement by Mr. Harden as well, they had access to everything, so consequently that would include that. If that was so, and let's assume that it's so, that's 1986, that's not really the same financial situation that we're looking at in 1988, okay, which is when this lawsuit is filed. And so I think that is a potential situation. As I said, the information was given in the arbitration hearings where we had been totally replaced, and we didn't have anything to do with that. And finally, it really gets down to, on these particular issues, I mean, that doesn't have anything to do with the issue in this particular lawsuit, it's on policy. So I really think that on that particular financial statement, the condition is public. If it's not public, we don't have it. If we did have it, assuming the presumption it was more than 2 years ago, it really isn't relevant to the search situation. And the testimony, again, something I really understand the testimony, that there, one of the points which I think relates to your point is the financial effect, the cancellation of the reinsurance would have, i.e. insolvency of the Western Fire. The clear testimony at this hearing, I will refer to page 51, when John Lybrand, the representative of the bank, was asked, did anyone from Western Fire try to hide the fact that they did not have sufficient assets to pay all the claims that had been filed by First Republic Bank at that time? No, not to the best of my knowledge. As a matter of fact, did they say just the opposite? They said if they had to pay all the claims that had been filed by First Republic, I believe the word Mr. Harden used was insolvent. Now this is Western Fire in 1988 telling the public bank voluntarily that if we have to pay all your claims, we're going to be insolvent. The same Western Fire is now suggesting that because this law firm had access to information 2 years ago, that it would show that they were insolvent to pay claims to Republic Bank. They have already admitted what they are questioning us about. And I think that is more than sufficient answer to the claim that, well, we would know what the financial effect is. They told the bank specifically they would be insolvent. You can't get any clearer than out of the horse's mouth. The suggestion about, well, the issues aren't the same. Information might have been public. Let's assume that, you know, we told you that we're going to be insolvent, but the mere appearance of impropriety is enough under Canon 9 to cut you out. I think that's something the court needs to address. Is the mere appearance of impropriety enough? Several courts have said no. Dinger versus Ulanov. I don't believe that side is not brief. 661 Fed Sub 438 specifically says, and that is again out of Eastern District of New York, where the test is, are the issues patently clear or are they basically the same? It specifically says that the mere appearance of impropriety is not sufficient basis for granting the motion to disqualify an attorney. Now,
do you agree there's a conflict between the Second and the Fifth Circuits?
Between Second and Fifth, no. I think that the Fifth Circuit.
Or this would be following Second Circuit if the conflict is.
Well, yeah, if there was conflict, I certainly agree to follow Second Circuit. I believe under the Fifth Circuit, corrugated. Container case, which is cited, does say by both sides, does say substantially related to, and the issues have to be so substantially related to that in that situation, you would have access to privileged information. The Heisel Company, believe cited in our brief, if not, it's 553 Fed Sub 552. Likewise, says the same thing, and it says, interestingly enough, it does say that the court will not. In a Canon 9 situation, it says that it will not liberally apply a Canon 9 disqualification, that it is very cautious to apply simply a Canon 9 violation. Okay, it says the rule of disqualification is not mechanically applied in this circuit, citing the Fifth Circuit, citing the corrugated container case. So, no, we don't think that the Fifth Circuit is contrary to the Second Circuit. The Seventh Circuit, now, which we can talk about, is, in fact, has a more liberal standard than the Second or the Fifth Circuit. They have a free content. The Fifth Circuit, we think, is a test that they haven't used the words identical patently clear as far as I know, but I think the results of their decisions are really the same. The hydro test, which I'm talking about, the firm, that has some similarities. They had represented a company and had represented them, in that case, for a number of years. Here, of course, in a 5-month situation, they ruled that the attorney was not disqualified because the issues weren't the same, even though they were trademarked. Even though that the attorney had represented the company trying to disqualify in connection with the trademark matter, that the particular trademark involved didn't come into play for a couple of years later, and so consequently could not have represented them on that exact trademark. Again, here the default of the insurance policy has occurred in 1988, more than 2 years after we were no longer involved in the case. So we really submit that the mere appearance of impropriety by itself, it is not enough to disqualify. It really shouldn't be enough to disqualify. The representation confirmed that the issues are, in fact, not in management way, which is really good on the other side, and that we think that this is a good case to report to clarify the technical law and hopefully to do what we believe the law should be, and that is to state the issues need to be identical, substantially clear, and that we have to analyze the issue and not just take the direct law.
Thank you, Tim. The court will take another brief recess.
Can I please rise?